The following morning, Merrin was at the practice butts with the archers. At first he had difficulty in keeping his balance with only one eye to steady him, but with fierce concentration he was at last able to master his unruly senses and train them anew. His next difficulty came in estimating the range and the holdover of his aim. His arrows either dropped away before they reached the target, or flew high above it. Grimly he persevered. Taita, who had been the champion archer in all the armies of Queen Lostris, coached him, teaching him the technique of letting fly his first arrow as a marker and using it to correct the second, which he released immediately afterwards. Soon Merrin could loose a second while the first was still in flight. Fen and Shuluk wives made him a leather eye-patch to cover the unsightly socket. His countenance regained its natural healthy hue, and the remaining eye its old sparkle. Every morning Taita sent out a mounted patrol, but they returned each evening without having discovered any sign of the Basmara regiments. Taita consulted Imbali and her women. "We know Chief Basma well. He is a vengeful, merciless man," Imbali told him. "He has not forgotten us. His regiments are scattered along the hills of the valley of the Great Rift, in the river gorges and the marshes of the lakes. It will take time for him to muster them, but in the end he will come. We can be certain of it." Now that the most important preparations had been completed, Taita had time for less vital work. He showed the women how to make dummy human heads with lumps of clay and grass set on top of long poles. These they painted with natural pigments until the results were convincing when seen from a distance. They enjoyed this more than arrow-making. However, the waiting was starting to wear on their nerves. Even considering the distance they must cover from here to Kyoga, Basmara should have arrived, Taita told Merrin, as they ate their dinner round the campfire. Tomorrow you and I will ride out to scout the terrain for ourselves. And I shall go with you, piped up Fen. We shall see about that when the time comes, said Taita gruffly. Thank you, beloved Taita, she said, her smile sweet and sunny. That was not what I meant, he replied, but they both knew that it was. The child was endlessly fascinating, and Taita delighted in her presence. He felt that she had become an extension of his own being. When the patrol rode out, Fen was between Taita and Merrin. Nkontu and Imbali trotted ahead as trackers to read the sign. On her long legs, Imbali could match Nkontu over the leagues. Khabari and two troopers brought up the rear. For once, Taita wore a sheathed sword at his waist, but carried his staff in his hand. They rode along the crest of the hills, whence they could look down the full length of the valley. On the left, the terrain was rolling and heavily forested. They saw numerous large herds of elephants spread out below the ridge. Their huge grey bodies showed up clearly in every open glade, and every so often a large fruit-bearing tree was sent crashing to earth by their massive strength. When a tree was too strong to yield to the efforts of a single beast, the other bulls came to his assistance. No tree could resist their combined assault. Since the tribes had fled from this land, the elephant had not been molested, and they were unalarmed by the close proximity of humans. They did not flee at the first approach, but stood their ground while the horsemen passed close by. Occasionally, a cantankerous female indulged in a threatening display, but none pushed home her attack. Fen was delighted by the antics of the calves and plied Taita with questions about the mighty beasts and their ways. The elephants were not the only wild animals they encountered. There were herds of antelope, and yellow baboons foraged in the open glades or swarmed nimbly on the tops of the tallest trees. One troop erupted into shrieking panic. The mothers snatched up their infants and slung them under their bellies as they bounded away in flight. The big males formed a belligerent rear guard, fluffing out their manes and uttering explosive barks of fury. "What ails them?" Fen demanded. "Likely a leopard or some other predator." As Taita spoke, a beautiful gold and black spotted cat stalked out of a patch of grass just ahead. The leopard's markings blended perfectly with the background. "You were right again, Taita. You must know everything there is to know in this world," Fen told him admiringly. They angled up the slope of the next range of hills, but before they reached the crest, a vast herd of zebra thundered over the skyline. Their hooves tore up the dry earth and lifted a cloud of pale dust high into the brazen sky. They took little notice of the horses, seemingly accepting that they were of their own species, and passed them within a few paces. "Something must have alarmed them," Merrin said. "Fire or men," Taita agreed. "Nothing else would have caused a stampede on this scale." "I see no smoke of a bushfire," Merrin said. "It must be men." They rode cautiously now, approaching the skyline at a walk. Suddenly, Fenn exclaimed again and pointed to the left. "A child! A little black child!" It was a naked infant of no more than 3 or 4 years. He was toddling up the slope on bowed legs, his plump little buttocks wobbling with each pace. "I'm going to pick him up," Fenn exclaimed. She pressed Whirlwind into a trot, but Taita grabbed her rein. "Fenn, this smells like ripe bait." "We cannot let him go," Fenn protested, as the child went over the skyline and disappeared. "He is lost and all alone." "We will follow him," Taita agreed, "but with caution." He did not release his hold on Whirlwind's rein as they rode on. He halted 100 paces below the ridge. "Come, Merrin," he ordered. They dismounted and passed their reins to Fenn. "Stay here and hold our horses, but be ready to ride hard," Taita told her. He and Merrin went forward on foot. They used a small bush to break up the outline of their heads as they peered over the far slope of the hill. The child stood just below them, facing them with a cheerful grin on his round face. He was holding his tiny penis in both hands, piddling a yellow stream onto the sun-baked earth. It was such a homely scene that it lulled them for a moment. Merrin started to grin in sympathy, but Taita seized his arm. "Look beyond!" They stared for an instant longer. Then Merrin reacted. "The Basmara impis," he cried. "That little devil was the bait." Not 50 paces beyond where the child stood, they squatted rank upon close-packed rank. They were armed with wooden clubs, long-throwing spears, and shorter, stabbing assegais tipped with sharp flint. Their rawhide shields were slung upon their backs, and their features were daubed with coloured clay to form warlike masks. They wore headdresses of fur and feathers. Ivory pins pierced their nostrils and earlobes, while bracelets and anklets of ostrich shell and ivory beads adorned their limbs. As Taita and Merrin looked at them, a hum, as though from a disturbed beehive, went up from the close-packed masses. With a single concerted movement, they unslung their war shields and drummed upon them with their spears. Then they burst into their battle hymn. The deep, melodious voices soared and swelled with the drumming. Then the din was pierced by a shrill blast on an antelope horn whistle. This was the signal for the ranks to leap to their feet, and in a mass they started up the slope. "Back to the horses," said Taita. Fenn saw them coming and galloped to meet them, bringing Windsmoke and Merrin's steed. They mounted swiftly and had turned the horses' heads as the first rank of Basmara warriors burst over the crest behind them. They galloped back to where Habari and the remainder of the patrol were waiting. "Already they have sent out men to try to head us off," Fenn called, rising in the stirrups and pointing into the forest. Now they could make out figures among the trees, racing to surround them. "Take my stirrup rope," Taita called to Nakontu, as he kicked his left foot free of the loop. Nakontu grabbed it. "Merrin, pick up Imbali to cover your blind side." Merrin swerved, and Imbali snatched the right loop. She and Nakontu were carried along by the horses, their feet skimming the earth. "Ride hard," Taita shouted. "We must break through before they encircle us." The fastest runners among the Basmari were streaking ahead of their companions. "Fenn, stay between Merrin and me. Don't allow yourself to be separated from us." 4 of the racing Basmara cut in directly ahead of them, closing the gap for which Taita had been aiming. They turned to face the oncoming riders, their tall shields on their backs, so that their hands were free to use their weapons. Taita and Merrin slipped their short recurved cavalry bows, designed to be shot from horseback, from their shoulders as they closed in. They dropped the reins onto the necks of their mounts, and guiding them with the pressure of their feet and knees, rode straight at the spearmen. A Basmara hurled his spear. He was aiming at Merrin, but the range was long. Merrin had time to react. With a touch of his toe, he turned the bay, and the spear flew past his left shoulder. He raised his bow and loosed two arrows in rapid succession. One flew high, almost an arm's length over the man's head, and went on for 50 paces. At this close range, the bow was massively powerful. But the second hit the Basmara in the centre of his chest and flew clean through him. It burst out between his shoulder blades in a spray of blood. He was dead even before he hit the ground. Out on the right, the second spearman heaved back his throwing arm. He, too, was concentrating on Merrin, and he was in Merrin's blind zone. Merrin did not see him, so made no effort to defend himself. Imbali swung out on the rope stirrup and threw her axe, which cartwheeled through the air. The Basmari's weight was on his back foot. He was in the very moment of his throw, unable to dodge or duck. The axe struck him in the middle of the forehead and buried itself deep in his skull. Imbali leant down to retrieve it as they swept by. Taita shot an arrow into the body of the third spearman, who dropped the weapon he had been about to throw and tried to pull the arrow out of his belly, but the barbs had bitten deep. The fourth and last warrior stood his ground. He was poised to make his throw, the shaft of the spear resting on his right shoulder. His eyes were bloodshot with battle rage, and Taita saw that they were fastened on Fen. She was sitting high on Whirlwind's back, a perfect target. The Basmara grimaced with the effort of launching the heavy spear at her. Taita knocked another arrow from his quiver. "Down, Fen!" he commanded in the voice of power. "Lie flat!" She dropped forward and pressed her face into Whirlwind's mane. Taita threw up his bow, drew until the bowstring touched his nose and lips, then released the arrow. The spearman was already swinging his body into the forward stroke, but Taita's flint arrowhead hit the notch at the base of his throat and killed him instantly. However, the spear had already left his hand. Taita watched, helpless, as it flew straight at Fen. She had her face down and did not see it coming, but Whirlwind did. As it flitted across his nose, he shied violently to one side and threw up his head so that Taita lost sight of the spear for a moment. He thought that it had missed her, and he felt a leap of relief. But then he heard her cry out in pain and surprise and saw her writhe on the colt's back. "Are you hit?" Taita shouted, but she did not reply. Then he saw the shaft of the spear dangling down Whirlwind's flank, dragging along the ground behind him. Taita turned Windsmoke behind the colt and saw at once that the head of the spear was lodged in Fen's bare thigh. She had dropped the reins and was clinging with both hands to the colt's neck. She turned towards him, and Taita saw that she was ash-pale, her green eyes seeming to fill half of her face as she stared at him. The shaft of the spear was bucking and kicking as it bounced along the ground, and he knew that the razor edges of the head were working brutally in her flesh, worrying and enlarging the wound. It had lodged close to the femoral artery. If it severed that great blood vessel, she would be dead within minutes. "Hold hard, my darling!" he called, and glanced over his shoulder. He saw a pack of Basmara in full pursuit after them, baying as they raced through the forest. "We dare not stop. If we do, they will be upon us in an instant. I am coming to get you." Taita drew his sword and came up beside the colt. He measured his stroke carefully. The sight of the girl in such anguish seemed to restore the strength he had thought lost so many years ago. He focused his mind on the jerking spear. As he swung the heavy bronze blade, he shouted a word of power, "Kadash!" In his grip the weapon seemed to take on a life of its own. There is a spot on the cutting edge of a well-balanced blade where all the weight and energy of the blow is concentrated. It caught the hardwood shaft precisely a finger's length above the leather bindings that secured the shank of the head and sliced through it as though it were a green twig. The shaft dropped away, and he saw the instant relief that lit Fen's features. "I am coming to get you," he told her, as he slipped the blade back into its scabbard. "Be ready." He pushed Windsmoke in beside her colt, and Fen opened her arms to him trustingly. He slipped his own arm round her waist and lifted her across the gap. She wrapped her arms round his neck as he sat her sideways across Windsmoke's withers. "I was so afraid, Taita," she whispered, "until you came. Now I know it will be all right." "Hold tight," he ordered, "or it will be all wrong." With his teeth, He tore a strip of linen from the hem of her tunic, then pressed the stub of the severed shaft flat against her upper thigh and secured it with the linen. "Not very neat or pretty," he told her, "but you are the bravest girl I know, and that will hold it firmly until we get back to Tamafupa." The pursuing Basmara dropped back and soon disappeared from sight among the trees. They were able to rein down to a trot, but still reached the gates of Tamafupa before the sun had made its noon. "Stand the garrison to arms," Taita ordered Merrin. "Those devils will be upon us before another hour has passed." He lifted Fen down from Windsmoke's back, carried her to the hut they shared, and laid her gently on her sleeping mat.